My name is Richard Lamposky, and I don't have one question in front of me because I've got a co-hostess for this program, Mary Jane Higby. She's been here so many times that we can't even call her a guest anymore. You must feel at home, don't you?
I feel at home and very happy here.
Tell them what we're going to talk about today.
Today we're going to talk about Pepper Young's family.
And guess who's here? Mason Adams? How long were you Pepper Young?
I was Pepper Young, I think, for about 16 years.
And who's this man you brought with you?
And happily with us today is Chick Vincent, who directed Pepper Young for how many years?
You predated 18, 19 years. It almost turned out to be a steady job.
You stole my joke. No, I was lucky enough when I assumed the part of Pepper to... The director was there already, and Chick was director, and in my book, he was just about the best director in daytime radio. Nighttime, too, for that matter.
You're prejudiced, Mason.
True.
How old was Pepper supposed to be?
When I became Pepper, I was somewhere in my 30s, I guess, and I always kind of figured that he was in his 30s then. He started out as a boy of about 14 or 15, didn't he?
He grew up in the part.
Yeah, and I guess he probably grew a year every 3 or 4 years, something like that. For each story year, I suppose he must have 3 or 4 actual years passed, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I think it would be very difficult to compute.
I assumed the part, he was an adult. He wasn't married when I started playing.
No,
it, but
Linda was still chasing him.
Right. He ultimately got married and had children. Or a child. I can't even remember now. Was it one or more?
I don't remember if he had any.
Maybe
that brings me to a question I want to ask you. Do you remember the plot lines of the shows you did very well?
Not very well. No, I remember some of them.
The outstanding things of the... I imagine... Can you even remember all of the radio programs on which you appeared? I mean, the different series. Could you say, well, yes, I was on this or I was on that? Definitely.
I don't think there are very many radio programs you can mention that Mason hasn't appeared on at one time.
That's what I'm getting at. I think you might be able to knock off the names of the ones that you weren't on.
I wasn't on a lot of daytime shows. I mean... Pepper kind of precluded acting on other daytime shows. I remember appearing on Road of Life in the morning, and every once in a while on, let's say, on Aunt Jenny, which was not a continuing story, but different stories each week. But I did a lot of nighttime stuff.
Yes, I had in mind just radio shows because it was difficult for you to understand in the beginning, wasn't it, Dick, that some of us couldn't even remember the shows we'd done.
Yeah, I was floored. A couple of people called, they said, I don't even remember being on that program.
Yes, Well, that wasn't true of directors, of course, because you had all the preparation.
I can name them pretty well, the shows I was connected with. Pepper Young's Family, Life Can Be Beautiful, The Shadow... Nick Carter, The Adventures of Charlie Chan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I remember them pretty well.
Life Can Be Beautiful was the one that was referred to in the trade always as LCBB.
LCBB, that's right.
How did that come about, Jim?
Well, Life Can Be Beautiful happened to be a pretty long title, and the authors of Life Can Be Beautiful were doing another show called This Day Is Ours, which I also had the pleasure of being associated with. And to make it simple, from an agency point of view and... show point of view, Life Can Be Beautiful became LCBB, and This Day Is Ours became TDIO.
TDIO.
It's simple.
Originally, I thought there was a show called LCBB.
LSIEBBE.
And then, I don't know whether anyone has ever told a story on any of your programs about the Leon Janney Charlie Chan story. Did anybody ever tell you that?
No.
Well, Chick, of course, directed Charlie Chan, and at that time, I suppose, was Santos Ortega playing Charlie, or was it Ed Begley when Leon was number one son?
Well, you have to... Leon was always number one son.
Yeah, well, at any rate, I think it was Santos, because that's right. Santos went out of the studio, and his watch was a little slow, and Charlie Chan had the opening speech, did he not? And Santos had the wrong time and was late. Somebody had to say the speech, and so Janney jumped into the breach, and... whatever the speech was, he delivered it. Then in came Santos in a state of considerable confusion, and the show went on. After the show was over, Leon called up his mother, and he said, "Hey, did you hear the show?" She said, "Yes." He said, "How did you like me?" She said, "Oh, Leon, you could do better than that."
If I may deviate, and while we're on the subject of Charlie Chan, is another incident comes to mind. At the time, Ed Begley was playing Charlie Chan, and in those days we had a repeat show for the West Coast. And in between shows, Ed used to go down to the Lambs Club and rest in between shows and come on back for the repeat show. I don't know what happened to him, but he got down to the club and was having a jolly good time or fell asleep in one of the chairs or something. Came time for the repeat show, and no Ed Begley. And Ralph Camargo happened to be on the show, so we made some last-minute switches, which had to be done. And I said, "Ralph, please play the lead. I don't care what. Play the lead." And all I can tell you, it's the first time that Charlie Chan was played with a Spanish accent.
Yes, that sudden switching of parts, that happened quite often. And I don't think people realize that there was always a pool of actors at the NBC drugstore or the restaurant called Colby's under CBS. And we'd go in there for a sandwich, and sometimes a frantic director like Chick Vincent would run in and say, "Is there anyone here? Oh, yes, will you come upstairs, please?" Because someone had not got in from New Jersey, or there was a blizzard, or someone had forgotten. And you all recall the repeat? The repeat shows that we had to do for the coach?
Oh, yes. That's what happened with the Charlie Chan situation with Ralph Camargo.
That was the repeat, yes.
He didn't show up for the repeat show.
That was
the
repeat. You said that, yes. I didn't know.
Wasn't Pepper Young one of the programs that was on twice a day?
Not when I was on it.
Yes, at one time, Pepper Young was on NBC, and it also was on CBS.
I
used to run from CBS to NBC to do the show.
You know, the first Pepper Young was Burgess Meredith, and I was flying to California a few years ago, and Meredith was on the plane, and mid-flight I went up to him and introduced myself, and I said, "You realize that if something happens to this plane, the only two extant Pepper Youngs will perish." Except that when he played the part, it was called Red Adams. The character was the Adams family, and then they got a chewing gum sponsor, as Elaine Carrington told it to me, and I guess they got Wrigley's as a sponsor, and so there was Adams chewing gum. They had to change the name. That's how it became Pepper Young instead of Red Adams.
I think it worked out very well. It's a much better title, because you can't forget Pepper Young's family, and I think Red Adams is really a pretty run-of-the-mill idea.
Culpepper. Culpepper,
that's... Was it Culpepper? Was that... Oh, well, that was a very clever idea. Why do you think it was so terribly successful? Because certainly it was one of the most successful of all of the daytime serials.
Elaine had the magical touch. She knew how to write for that particular audience, just as in When a Girl Marries and in Rosemary. What the formula is, I wouldn't be able to... I have no idea.
Well, I'll try, Mason. Yeah. Elaine Carrington had the happy faculty of knowing people. She touched the grass roots. Pepper Young's family was motivated by nothing other than love of family. Mother for father for mother and father for kids for mother and father. Friends, family was the most important thing in the world. And she wrote about family and friends. If a waif came along, they would take the waif into the house and give it a helping hand, or give her or him a helping hand. And people could readily identify with everything she wrote about, and they just loved it.
What sort of income bracket was the Pepper Young family?
Oh, he was very, very middle class. Pepper was editor of a newspaper, and money was never really mentioned.
Was it a small town?
Well, it was a small town, and they were comfortable. Did they have a servant? Yes, of course. What was it?
Hattie,
sure. They had a live-in housekeeper, but they never, rich they weren't, but I guess...
They came by hard times, too, when the plant burnt down, Mason, until you went to work in the newspaper and brought some income in. They had their ups and downs, just as people today in real life have their ups and downs.
Did Pepper ever get married?
Yes, I married my girlhood sweetheart, Linda. When I first came on the show, he was in love with, was it Diana Green? The actress was Rosie Green.
Rosie Green
was the actress, and her name was something Green. Diana Green, yeah. She was a little bit older than Pepper, and...
My gosh, we're going back.
Yeah, we're going way, way back to when I first joined the show, and he was in love with her, and the family kind of looked askance because she was an older woman, and... One thing or another, and she had a bad... Did she have a... No. Somebody had a bad brother.
You do remember Plot, dear.
Oh,
better than I do.
Well, you know, what was the character that was played by DeWolf, that lovely...
Marie
DeWolf. What was her character? She had a terrible brother, didn't she? The convolutions of plot on these shows, they were really fantastic when you think about them. And yet they always paid off. I mean, there was a suspension of disbelief on the part of audiences. They were involved. Listen, they believed so strongly. Elaine told a story about the actor Jack Rosalie, was it? Jack what?
Yes,
was that his name? Who had played Father Young died. And they got another actor to play the part, naturally Tom Chalmers, who was my father for practically all the time that I was on it. One of the specialties of the show was a bedroom, an in-bed scene between Mother and Father Young at the end of the day discussing what had transpired. When Jack Rosalie died and they replaced him with another actor, they received mail from women saying, please do not have any more bed scenes. We cannot imagine Mrs. Young in bed with another man. That's true. People would write in like that. Well, people wrote two characters.
May I interrupt you?
Sure.
I'll even bring it down a little closer. When you were dating the character played by...
Diana was her name.
Tons of mail came in from our listening audience saying, how could Pepper marry anyone but Linda? This is unheard of. This is written. Please, what are you doing, Pepper? It goes on and on. By the barrelfuls, mail came in.
I wonder what kind of mail they're getting on the television soaps today.
Same kind of mail.
Well, they're doing more than going to bed with their married spouse on television programs that I see.
This is a big change. I want, Mason, please, tell about the story of the lady, about the letter, of the lady who wanted you to, I think she proposed marriage, and she wanted to write just the title.
Oh, yes. Well, no, that was many years ago on Road of Life. I played a handsome, ne'er-do-well, man-about-town type who was also a freelance writer. I don't remember the name. Clifton something. Anyhow, one day, P&G sent me a letter addressed to this character. And this woman, it was a proposal of marriage from a woman to the character. She said that she specialized in writing titles and that she would... we should get married, and I should peddle her titles and go 50-50 on it. Two of the titles she gave me were The Passersby and The Pot. I don't know what you could do with
it. I wonder if she held on to that title.
She was as mad as a hatter. Well, you got letters like
that. She has the rights today.
Well,
they might be able to make a deal.
You know, on Grand Central Station, they got a call from... I appeared on a show and with a certain plot line. One of the local stations, it was live, then called New York CBS, said, we have a woman here who says that man is her long-lost son, and we don't know what, do something. She insists that this, they believed, and they were so involved. Ready for the funny farm.
I want to play for the audience, because we've already heard it, an old recording from an album which I'm constantly plugging. It's called Themes Like Old Times from 90... Genuine original curtain raisers. They're themes from old radio programs, and one is Pepper Young. We're going to hear that right now.
Pepper Young's Family. The story of your friends, the Youngs, is brought to you by Camay, the mild beauty soap for a smoother, softer complexion.
I think it's marvelous, Mary Jane Habe. You're sitting here not saying a word about your book. Not a word. And the book is about radio. Have you all read it? It's called Tune In Tomorrow. It is a pleasure. And it's published by Kohl's, and it's $5.95, and it's full of pictures. And it's a great book. It's in its second printing,
yes,
right?
It is already.
Yeah, it's really a fine
and
book.
And it has the story about the pot, which I got from Mason Adams.
I wonder if this program is on, whether I'm doing it or whoever's doing it in 10 or 15 years, if people will be as excited to be on from old television shows, Will they inspire that kind of loyalty?
I would be interested now in seeing some of the people, if they're still able to get around, live television.
Yeah, live television.
It's so horrendous.
The day-by-day grind must be a terrible grind, I would think.
Must have been
terrible. Whereas radio was a continual blah. We had the greatest time in the world, didn't we?
Yes.
We didn't know it at the time.
We didn't realize
what
a marvel
it at the time.
Well, but the variety of experiences that we were able to have, superficial though they may have been, and handheld scripts and all the rest of it, you know, it was quite unique to be able to go from doing a Pepper Young to doing Gangbusters or Charlie Chan or whatever it might have been, FBI and Peace and War. Yeah, that was the name of one of the shows. It was really quite unique, and I guess it will never have it again, but we were lucky to have been in it.
Yes, the camaraderie is no longer existing in our business. The days of radio, there was great camaraderie. There was one always helping the other. You don't find this closeness in television.
Is it because, though, Chick Vincent, that it's a more hurried life for the actor? Or is it the medium or the time?
I think it's the medium. It's hard work doing a daytime soap. But I like to think that it's the people themselves. We were a group of people in radio. We were a family. Where if God forbid, somebody was in trouble, you name the trouble. Word got around that industry, and all possible help went forward to that person. If I got sick and I couldn't do my show, I would call up Carlo D'Angelo and say, "Don't worry, Chick, get better, I'll do your show." When Jerry Devine lost his father, "Chick, don't worry, Jerry, I'll do Mr. District Attorney for you." There was a feeling, there was a camaraderie that I don't feel in the television industry today.
Do you think the pressures are too great, Chick? I mean, they're so big, everyone's learning lines, they're trying.
Possibly.
There isn't time. I think perhaps the feeling is the same because many of the people are the same, aren't they?
No, I don't think the people are the same. There have been an influx of new actors into the television medium that came from the theater, came from many, many different areas that we didn't have in radio. Now, I don't mean to demean any form of entertainment here, but there were tremendous actors from the theater that once they got into a radio studio and you put a script in front of their hands, they were lost. They're not lost in a TV studio, but they were lost facing this little box, picking up a script. "Read cold for me. Let's go." They couldn't cut it. They couldn't cut it. This was a special breed of cat we had in radio to do radio programs. And God bless them. And every one of them that went on to Hollywood to bigger and better things have all turned out to be tremendous stars because of that radio training they had in background. That's my piece for today.
Who were some of the people you directed or worked with who went on?
Oh, Richard Widmark, Frank Lovejoy,
Tony
Heflin, Tony Randall,
Ed Begley,
Agnes Moorehead, goes on and on and on. They've all gone on to a greener pasture.
Yeah, but it is true. Some of the shows would occasionally have young budding stars like Marlon Brando once on Grant. So he couldn't. It was not as brilliant a genius as he was and still is. Radio was. He was totally incapable of doing radio. Many theater actors. So it was a technique that defied them. You know, they just couldn't manage it.
If I may tell a little tale, I don't think it's telling tales out of school. I was doing a half-hour nighttime show. And a very, very, very famous actor, I don't want to name him, was the guest on the show. And in those days, I had a conflict, so my assistant took over the first reading, and I would get to the theater, and we'd go into rehearsal.
The conflict being you were doing another show
at
the same time.
That is correct. And this star said, "May I talk to you, Mr. Vince?" and pulled me aside out into the wings of the theater, and he said, "Look, I'm from the theater, I'm from motion pictures. This is a new medium to me. I'm a little lost. I need help. Please help me. Nobody has told me anything." It was totally different from doing a stage play or a motion picture where you rehearse for days and days, or you do a bit scene in motion pictures and then they set up again, you do another two lines. Once you were on, and that was it. You went. You had to go from top to bottom. That is before the days of tape.
When did tape come in, or it was used? Regularly, where it was tape.
Well, this is a calculated guess. I would say tape came in about 15 years ago.
It was after the Second World War, because I think Crosby's was the first show that was
done. Oh,
yes,
it was in the 50s. When tape was used with any regularity.
With any regularity, yes.
Yeah, I would say in the mid-50s.
Yes, they were very cagey about using. They didn't like any recorded effects on network in the beginning at all, and that was part of that. That's why they wouldn't use tape, even though they had it. But do you think it was as difficult for the radio actor to make the step into the theater? Because Mason, I suppose you came from the theater, though.
Well, I had, done a lot of theater work.
But it's interesting to know that Pepper Young just was playing the leading role in You Know I Can't Hear You When the Water's Running in London, England. And that's, to some people, it would seem like a big step from Pepper Young's family, but...
No, well, I had been in the theater before I got into radio. As a matter of fact, I remember when I graduated from college and came to New York, I had nothing but contempt for radio. I said, if I can't be a legitimate actor, I'm not going to be anything. And little did I know that I would change my mind very rapidly and happily and became an effective radio actor, which some people use it as
a great
derogation.
Great medium.
How did you happen to go into radio?
How did I happen?
I've always wondered how directors were drawn to this.
Well, how much time do we have, sir?
Oh, we have 10 minutes.
Remember 1929?
Yes.
I was going to college, and I had 1 year of college under my belt, and Dad said, I'm sorry, son, that's it. We all have to pitch in and put our shoulders to the wheel. Well, while at school, I used to write music, and I wrote some songs for some school plays we had put on, and I thought I'd go down and conquer Tin Pan Alley. In making the rounds of Tin Pan Alley, I met a man by the name of Ken Sisson, who in that day was considered one of the best arrangers of modern American music. He took a shine to me, and I took a shine to him, and he gave me a job working with him, and he was doing such shows as Showboat in those days, the music, arranging, the Andre Castellanos Chesterfield Hour. And I learned orchestration, point and counterpoint and harmony. Now I was in the musical end of the business. I'd studied music all my life anyway. Then one day we were doing a show, the Log Cabin Inn, I shall never forget this day so long as I live, with Lanny Ross and Harry Salter and his orchestra. And we were doing a dress rehearsal, and it was around Easter time, and the client was in town with his little children with their Eton suits on and what have you. And one of the little boys in the control room said, tugged at his daddy's coattail. He says, Daddy, how come they aren't playing on the Good Ship Lollipop, which was popular in those days with Shirley Temple? And so Dad said, yeah, how come we're not playing on the Good Ship Lollipop? Well, needless to say, Ken and I went home out to Long Island that night, and we worked all night arranging on a Good Ship Lollipop. In those days, we used to have the dress rehearsal before the day of broadcast, so in case there were any changes, we could fix the show up. I come in the following morning without any sleep, and the show goes on the air that night, and now a brand new so-and-so arrangement of On the Good Ship Lollipop. And I said to Ken, who are they kidding? Ken, I haven't been to bed yet, neither are you. What do you mean? It's our arrangement, not his. He's some sorry chick. They get all the money and all the glory. We don't. I said, well, this is not for me. I said, who is that guy over there telling everybody what to do? He said, he's the director. Why? I said, that's what I want to be. So I continued to work with Ken. And I found out that in those days, to be considered a good director, you should have some knowledge of music, which I had. You either had a flair for drama, or you didn't, interpretation. And you should have some writing sense to edit and show some continuity in script. So while working with Ken, I went back to college right in the studios, and I was lucky enough to have people like Innes Osborne, who in that day was the top writer in our industry, and Tiny Ruffner, who was a top announcer-producer, and Bill Batcher, who was a top producer. And I would sit in the corner with a script and watch what they did, and when the show got off the air, I would go over and say, why did you do this? I would have done it this way. And they taught me and showed me why they did what they did. So I developed, and I said, well, I'm making progress. We were doing an audition one day for a food company. I was working on a musical end with Ken Sisson and Harry Soller again. And the agency walked in with their client, and they said, okay, time to put the show together. Let's go put the audition together. So the agency guy says, I don't know how to do it. And the client says, I don't know how to do it. So I put my hand up. I said, if somebody will give me a stopwatch, I'll do it. So they gave me a stopwatch. I went out into the studio, and I put the show together, and we were long, our routine, the whole thing, and bing, bing, bing. We did the audition, and now I was ready for my bars. I was graduating now. I did my first show. Well, making the rounds, I'm taking too much of your time. Making the rounds of the agencies, nobody would give me a job. I looked like I was 12 years old. That's what motivated the mustache. Nothing happened. I couldn't get a job. So I said, I'm going to make my own job. So I put a show together. I took an article out of a newspaper called How He Proposed. This is long before soap operas even. And this was the gimmick of a 15-minute show I put together with a singer and a little ensemble. And this was the write-in How He Proposed. And if we read or dramatized your letter on the air, you'd get a beautiful diamond ring and stuff and stuff and stuff. So I brought this to an agency. They had a client called Sweetheart Soap. Well, this was dovetailed beautifully. So I made one stipulation. If they wanted this show, I had to direct it. I don't care if they paid me a dime or $1 million a week. Money was unimportant. I had to direct this show. Well, the head of the agency wanted to meet the nut who wouldn't sell a show unless he could direct it. So I had a meeting with the president. What do you know about directing? Have you ever worked in a local radio station? I said, no. I didn't have to work in a local radio station. I was brought up in reading the studios in New York. I learned my profession. Nope. He sent me to a place called WLW in Cincinnati, where I worked for 6 months, came back to New York, and everybody discovered me. And that's how I got into...
It's a wonderful story, Chick.
Really directing true. And producing.
Was your debut that involved, or did you just wander into radio?
I'm just trying to remember.
It wasn't the Depression, was it? But
no,
I finished
college in the early 40s, and then I was in the Army, and then came back, and... I don't really remember what...
Well, Pepper Young must have been one of your first things then.
It was later. Yeah, when I got back, it was in about 1944, I auditioned. And I remember I had signed a run of the play contract to go to Chicago and Dear Ruth. And I had to ask for my release. And, you know, they don't release you from a run of the play contract. We hadn't even gone to rehearsal. We were just about to go to rehearsal. And I was really scared that they wouldn't release me, but after... You know, they finally said, all right, you get an actor to replace you, and we'll give you the release. So I got on the phone, and all that weekend, I was trying to give away. It was the part that Bart Robinson originated. You remember the stuffy banker in Dear Ruth?
Mm-hmm.
That was a good part,
you
know. And, and I finally found somebody that with whom I had acted, who wanted it, whom they accepted. They gave me the release, and I was able to go on and be Pepper Young.
I've got one quick question for both Mary Jane and you, Mason. Do people ever recognize your voices?
Constantly. I have sat down. I've gone to Toronto. Not too long ago, I sat down and said to a waitress, may I have coffee and cake? She said, you were Pepper Young. That happens. It's fantastic.
Yes, people it happens to me a great deal.
Oh,
too.
Sure. They remember.
Which character do they remember best?
They remember. I think that they remember When a Girl Marries Joan. But sometimes they identify me as the heavy on Helen Trent. Never for any wonderful nighttime thing I did. Never know about that. It's always the daytime.
Well, they were the devoted listeners, people that listen, you know.
The one that made the biggest impression of me of your career, Mary Jane, was Cynthia Swanson. But probably because I listened to Helen Trent. It was at the lunch hour, and I'd come home and eat lunch. And
it may be the time.
Food and hissed you many an afternoon. I want to thank all of you for being here. Mason Adams, who was Pepper Young for so many years, and Chick Vincent, who is one of radio's top directors, and my co-hostess, Mary Jane Higbee. Tell me a little bit about your book. We've got about 30 seconds. What's the name?
The book is called Tune In Tomorrow, and it's published by Kohl's Book Company, Incorporated. And it deals a great deal with the sort of reminiscence you just heard today. I didn't have some of the facts I would like to have had for that book from Chick Vincent because I didn't know where you were.
I'm going to run out and buy it anyway.
You've got material now for a second book now, Mary Jane, after today. Anyway, the book is called Tune In Tomorrow, and it's written again by Mary Jane Higbee, and it's $5.95, and it's full of pictures, and I hope you all go out and buy it. So thanks, all of you, for being here.
Thank you.
And enjoy it. Until next week at the same time, this is Richard Lamparski. Thank you for listening. Good night.